Good evening, everyone. My name is Claire, and I'm an alcoholic. And I'm grateful to be sober and a proud member of the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I'd like to thank Natasha and Grant for, they're just so lovely. They drove all the way to L.A. to pick me up and drive me down here. I had a little eye surgery, and I was advised, I've driven around for many years down this area. I can't drive at night with the oncoming, just 4 weeks ago. The lights coming, so they offered to come. Thank you so much, and it was very sweet. And of course, I gave them a lecture all the way down about Alcoholics Anonymous. Thank you. I'd like to see. May I see the hands of the newcomers, both Al-Anon and Alcoholics? Thank you. Welcome. I am too a double winner. I'm so impressed with this your format. And I'm sober by the grace of God 34 years from my first meeting. And my sponsor sent me to Al-Anon at the end of my first year. And I have never in all these years, and I get the privilege to do this a lot all over the country, most of the world, and I've never seen, I've been in a meeting where you had this one. I am really impressed. And thank all of you for being here. We tell our story in a general way, what it used to be like, what happened, and what it's like to now. By the time I got to Alcoholics Anonymous, I was a roaring winette. And in the book, more, which is the basic text of our program, it talks about in chapter 3 more about alcoholism. The insane things we sometimes continue to do to keep from doing step 1, 2, and 3. And at the end of that reading, in those steps, and as they are listed, one of them says we look for natural wines. I had switched to Ripple, and that's not one of your natural wines. As a matter of fact, I don't think a single grape's ever been near that stuff. I don't know what they put in it, but by that time, I was literally doing a dance with death. So trouble when you're dancing with death, the music stops. And I come from the jazz world, Boston, New York, and Harlem, and I know about the music, and I know about the dance. And I knew at some point that I never dreamed that my life would end up the way it ended. Well, actually, I was born in Atlanta, Georgia, and I'm the youngest of 7 children. My father was a full-blooded Cherokee Indian of the Cherokee Nation. I was born and raised on a reservation in North Carolina. Left that reservation, I guess, when he was about 26 years old. Migrated in first into Alabama and then into Georgia. I'm not going to stay a few minutes in Georgia tonight. He met my mom, had these 7 children, and I was the youngest of the 7. My father was an artist and an entrepreneur and a very successful man and a very interesting man, actually. And he moved us to Atlanta so the children could have access to a better education. And they were born in Bainbridge, Georgia, and I was born in Atlanta. And I remember as a little child, I always felt different. I'm probably one of the ones that had the ism. I could have used a little drinky poo, probably in the first grade, you know, just to get me to the second grade. Because, I mean, I had trouble, you know, from a little kid, and my mom died, God rest her soul, when I was 3 months old. So I was left, you know, my dad was left with these kids, and he later, a couple of years later, married a woman who was my stepmother, and I was probably, you know, we talk about in the book, and we talk about the steps, about what it was like growing up, and I just remember being fearful, and I remember that she, which was a rather stern woman, and very religious, and I started having trouble with God, you know, long before I ever heard of Alcoholics Anonymous, or drinking, or anything that would make a difference in our lives. And my brothers and sisters all grew up, and they were all practically grown because they were so much older than I when I was, my mother had 10 children, actually. 3 miscarriages, and she was like only 46 years old. And in those days, I mean, they had huge families, and they didn't have the medical processes that are exposed to us now, and so she died just in childbirth. And I was 5 years old, and in the first grade when I heard that this woman was my stepmother. Anyway, I always felt afraid, and I was a loner, and I grew up in an area with my stepmother with this religious connotation of things that always frightened me. My father, I can still remember him. I'd look out this window. We had this big house, and I'd look out the window and see him out doing his Indian rituals. And I was always impressed with that, and, you know, and he would never go to the church, and so I grew up in that divided a sense of reality about God and all of that. I was somewhat talented, and I was a terrible student, and but I had some talent in art. I won an art scholarship from Booker T. Washington High School in Atlanta, and I'm going to have to tell you how old I am so you can follow me with this story. I'm 83 years old. I'll be 84 in January. And I tell you that because I start talking about things like World War II. So I think, so I thought I better hip you to, you know, my age. So, and when I talk about my age, I always say the best is yet to come. So I just go ahead and accept my age. I absolutely love my life. I would not have the life I have today if it wasn't for the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous. And I won the scholarship to Boston Museum School of Fine Arts, which is one of the finest art schools in this country, and which was almost unusual at that time for a black person. You know, I grew up when the culture of this country was a lot different. And I know a lot of those things I had fears about, you know, I had experienced growing up there, and the anger and the fear and all of the stuff. And so when I won that scholarship, that's how I got out of Atlanta. I had never heard of alcohol. I grew up in the Baptist church, and I haven't had any problems with that. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it resolved all those fears about it when it talks about in We Agnostics. But I remember one thing about that church is I always loved the music. But I really got a little tired of that minister and those preachers and the deacons praying over me as a sinner. And I'm 7 and 8 and 9 years old, and I don't know what it is I've done that's so bad that they keep reminding me of it. So, I mean, I had a problem with the church and my stepmother and God, and I was never allowed to do it. I never had friends. And when that's when fingernail polish and lipstick started. That's why I tell you how old I am. Started coming out in stores, and I was not allowed to do any of that. So I was always out in the woods painting or drawing, and I was a loner. And when I got that scholarship, I remember sitting on a segregated train out of Atlanta, and I was waving my finger. And I'm telling you, I'm 19 years old. I was never allowed to go to movies. I couldn't wear makeup. I was told how terrible boys were, stay away from them, and all this stuff that, you know, we learned about in the steps, set up all that fear. And I'm sitting there, you know, this is the ism. I'm saying I had no friends. I'm 19 years old, could never, I was out of space. I never heard of alcohol, because in the South in those days, below what they call the Mason-Dixon line, alcohol was forbidden in this country. So it was never legal. I got sober to learn that they had those. They made it out in the woods. They call it, I don't know, white lightning or something. I know now, but then I didn't know it existed on the earth. But I remember sitting on that train and saying, "I'll fix them," and they didn't know I was leaving town. And that was talking about resentment to be talking about in the steps. But I remember arriving in Boston and walking into that school, and it was incredible time. It was 1940, and the streets were, we were at war with Japan and Germany, and The streets were filled with servicemen. There was rarely, unless they were out of age, over the age for to be in the service, it was all sailors, and it was exciting, and it was its time, and the jazz world, and it was, I mean, I was so excited. And I looked around, and I went into that school, and I'm one of those that, you know, a couple of weeks of something, I'm interested in, and then if it's not exciting enough, I have to start looking for something else. I don't know if you're like that, but, you know, I had never been to a movie, so I said to this, I started going to the movies. I was amazed. I look up on that screen, the rooms were dark, and I look up there, and there's Fred Astaire and Ginger Rogers dancing. I'd never seen anybody dance because I never heard the music, except I always heard the church music, and you know, I didn't know anything about any other type of music. They and I was started hanging out there all the time. One night I decided to go ask a friend. We were walking down the street in Boston, and I heard this jazz music, which I absolutely started listening to. And the people walked out, and I said to her, Eleanor, why don't we just go in there and see what they're doing? We walk in there, and I shall never forget, it was dimly lit, and the aroma of the cigarettes and the booze, and down at the end of the bar was this little band and a rather portly lady, and she was singing the blues. And I remember my heart just started pounding. I looked down there, and I looked at her, and we go, and we sit on the stool. And I leaned, and the bartender leaned over, and he said, what are you going to have to drink? I had no idea. But I remembered in the movies, they always talked about martinis. And I was about to commit my first hip slick cool act. Because I leaned on that bar, and I looked at him dead in the eye, and I said to him, we'll have a martini, honey. I said, and make it dry. I had no idea what a dry martini was. But they always said that in the movies. And I saw, and he turned around with these two stem glasses, and he had a, and I know it was a blender, but he tied this can, and he leaned it up, and it looked like lemonade. I didn't, you know, in the South, it's all, we always was, I was used to seeing lemonade. I didn't know you sip drinks. So I look up and down the bar, which became a big habit later. You know, I'm up and down, and I picked it up, and I opened my mouth, and I dumped it. I was a pig from the gate. But I remember the way it made me feel. Man, I used to sulk. People used to punch me to try to make me smile growing up. I got a permanent smile on my face, and I walk out there as a little dance floor, and these couples were dancing, and I'd heard those messages from that stepmother about staying away from boys and stuff. Man, those fantasies came racing in there, and I got this smile, and I'm waving this empty glass in my hand, just moving it around. And that night, I got myself some new friends. I never had any old ones, but I got some new ones here, and I called them colorful, but the big book calls them loyal companions. I hooked up with the pimps, the madams, and the bad boys. And I learned to walk the walk and to talk the talk. And I never dreamed that 25 years later I would end up in South Central Los Angeles in the ghetto dying of alcoholism. But that first drink, I don't want to forever forget the first drink, and I don't want to forever forget the last drink. I've heard from the old timers around these meetings for all these years, if you forget your last drink, you know you're going to do it again. So I don't want to ever forget how I ended up down there. But I mean, now I am hanging out, man. I'm still in school, but I'm in those jazz clubs night after night. And it was wonderful. And you could walk into a club, and who's standing on that stage but the late great legend, Billie Holiday. And there was Duke Ellington, and there was Louis Armstrong, and I started hanging out with that lifestyle that lasted for 10 years. And I still did all the other things, but I'm one of the ones on page 21 of the Big Book of Alcoholics that talks about the real alcoholic. And I'm one of the ones who drank for a lot of years, didn't have blackout, you know, I was a heavy drinker, but it never really bothered me, really. And when I was about 16, 18 years sober, it started to change. As the book tells us, you know, I crossed that invisible line. I met a nice young man from a Boston family. We got married. We had a little son. And now I'm in the fast lane. And I am in those clubs. And And I became friendly, used to hang out with Billy. We, you know, we'd go out to after hour joints. It was wonderful and it was exciting. But something about kids, they grow up. They started looking at you with that look. In the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes the kind of alcoholic I was becoming at that time when it says, selfishness and self-centeredness that we think is the root of our troubles. And it goes on in that paragraph to say we're driven people. And we're driven by 100 forms of fear, self-delusion, self-seeking, and self-pity. And that nailed me because now the grandparents are raising him, and I go over there and I take that look at him, and he's looking at me with that look and saying those things like, but Mom, you promised me the last time you were here that you were going to take me to the park. You promised me this, and you promised me that. And I pat him on the head, and I say, yeah, baby, but next time. You see, because I had more important things to do sitting on the bar stools in Boston. And then we'd go over to New York and hanging out in Harlem. And when I get back, I take them a lot of gifts. And, you know, I send them to a better camp and then better schools and all that stuff. But I want to tell you something. I never could buy the love. Though I know about street life. You see, you can buy love in the streets. I still love jazz music. I listen to it every day. But there's one of the songs that's still out that I can relate to, and it is called Street Life. And the lyrics are paraphrasing when they say, you know, if you are young, don't get old in the streets, because the cold's going to hit you in the back and you're going to nickel and dime your life away. And you look back one day, it was all a masquerade, because there's 1,000 lives to play out there until you play your life away. And that's where I was. That I was just playing my life away, looking for more, greedy. You know, it would one drink was never enough, and a 1,000 never would have been enough. So I'm sitting on the bar stool one night, and my husband's family owned a trucking company, and he traveled a lot. But that relationship was, I was in that marriage 25 years. We drank drink for drink, and that's why I like about the Al-Anon, because we drank drink for drink. So I had no comparison, but when he was out, I still hung out with the same people. And I, you know, the thing about the progression of the disease, I'm now looking at other people. And I'm hanging, because it's not enough. I'm not getting enough out of this. And what's in it for me? You know, the part about the selfishness and the self-centeredness. And I thought, well, it would be with another relationship. And so I prayed about this man, you know. I'll describe him when I met him. I'm sitting there talking to Billy Holiday, this is true. And this man walked up, and it was in this jazz club, and the smoke, the cigarettes, and he had a black hat turned down all the way around. He had on a light blue top coat. And this dude was so cool, he couldn't get his arms through the sleeves. And he just leaned on that bar, and he peeled out of 10 $100 bills, and he spread it on the bar like this, and he took his hand, and he leaned over, and he said, spend it. I knew God had answered my prayer. I wasn't much of a prayer. I was not much of a prayer, because I didn't believe in God. I looked at that $100. That was a lot of money in those days. And he turned out to be the head of the mafia of the Boston family. Then I know what it's like to become associated with the head of the boss. I mean, the real man. I know what it's like to ride in limousines with bodyguards. And it was a lifestyle, and that's all it was. I know the difference today between a lifestyle and a life. And that's what it's, that the madness really started and the progression. And now we are going over, and when my husband came home, I introduced him to him. We all hung out together. I mean, that's just the way it was. And we are now, you know, my son is 10 years old, and something is about to change here. And we were going over to New York to this jazz club. It's even in history today. It's a famous club called Birdland. And a lot of you are young, and I'm not dropping names. It's just my story. And Billy Eckstine was the opening star that night. And so I remember we get in the limousine, and I called this man Mr. Wonderful. I never called him anything else, just Mr. Wonderful. We had these bodyguards. They sat, and it was one of those, if you guys like classic cars, it would be classic now. It was a Mercedes that had the white wall tires, and it had the trunk on the back, and it had the seat you pulled down where the bodyguard sat, and then they had the driver, and then they had me and him, and if the husband was there, he came too, and we all sat in the back. So we went over to New York. And driving back, if anybody was going to kill us, you know, in those days, the mob was really, I mean, it was like the goddess. I mean, it was like the Godfather. It was really like that. Because I remember when they wanted to go to the restroom, he'd send everybody to check the restroom before we could go to the restroom, anyway. So we are on the way back, and something happened. It was the beginning of what I call an Alcoholics Anonymous, those moments of clarity that you get over a period of years when you're destined to go to the very bottom, you know, fighting this disease and wanting to keep what you got and afraid that you're going to lose what you get, what you already have. And we're sitting in the back of that limousine, and he was asleep, the bodyguards were asleep, and it was on a Sunday morning. I've come to believe that God has always trying to get my attention on Sunday mornings. And I look out the window, and it was a beautiful day, and these young families were about to cross the street into this beautiful New England church. And it was like a voice said to me, "Clara, something is wrong with your life." And I agreed. It's Boston. Get out of town. Let's get out of town. And I said to my husband, I think, why don't we move to California? He had relatives here, and his aunt and uncle were famous dancers at MGM. And so I said, why don't we move to California? And he agreed it was a good idea. So typical alcoholic me, I just close up the house, left the furniture and everything in it, and I go pick up the kid, and he's 10 years old, and he looks at me, and I said, "We're going to move to California to see your aunts and uncles," and he thought it was a good idea, and I'll never forget that drive. Right out Rooster 66, right in L.A., and I mean, it was a wild drive, and I went with good intentions. See, but I'm an alcoholic. Because I was going to try to be a good mother to this little boy. I was going to try to live differently and be a lady. My Indian father used to say, "All I want from my daughters is to be serving ladies." And they gave us everything that's supposed to fit you, make you be somebody, but I missed that one. So I ended up hopping on the first bar stool right across the street from where that you guys picked me up today. That in those days was called the Ruby Art Room, and I climbed onto the stool, and I was off and running. By a fluke, I went into a little small business, and we got settled, and we had two more children, and now it's beginning to cross the line. I'm way on the other side of the line, because now I'm beginning. 10 years into that company, I've become very successful. What I did by fluke, I never got to teach art. The husband had a great job. My brothers and sisters moved from the East Coast, Boston and New York, and started their careers. And one of my sisters was a nurse, and she was a nurse at Cedars Sinai Hospital in Beverly Hills. And I was beginning to lose it all, thank you, God, that you took away from me everything I wanted in order to give me what I needed. But it came that time in my life when I needed to stop drinking and I needed to stop dying and I needed to find a God of my understanding. Now, the older son was 10 years older than the next son, and they began to lose it all. The banks repossessed all the vans. I had 20 employees and all this was going, and I can't stop drinking. And I'm in violent blackouts. I'd never had blackouts all those years, and it started. I'm ending up in County General Hospital downtown LA, being treated by USC in medical interns. You know, in those days, the way they treated you, because now they take the, like, again, when you get cut, when your skin is open, they stitch you up. And I got really nervous when I could see these little strings hanging off and they're sticking up the scars in my face where I'm getting beaten up. And I remember my husband came to me and he said, "You know, this is too much. He said, I can't live like this. Either you're going to kill me or I'm going to kill you. And I don't want our kids to see this anymore. We've been married at that time 25 years. And strangely enough, when I got sober, he drank all those years and he never really turned into an alcoholic. The minute he walked away from me, he just stopped drinking. I never have understood that. I watched the banks take everything. I came in here owing $20,000 pay. I mean, it was madness. I went to the hospital one day when they were going to take the house back. And the marshal with this green uniform on, and my son, the next son was then like 14. My daughter was maybe 10 and a half. And I went to her and I said, you know, we just need two payments to save the house. And she looked at us, at me, and she said, it pains us to watch you live the way you live. And I looked at that sister, that we were a close, loving family, and I could see her pain. She said, but you know, we're not going to sign any more checks. We're not going to bail you out of any more trouble. Because if you don't stop drinking, you're going to die. And man, with that, from my little girl and that stepmother telling me if I died, I was going to hell, and told me about the devil and what he was going to do with that pitchfork. When she said that, for some reason, the fear of death was haunting me right in the AA. I've dealt with it now through the steps. I darted out of there. And I went back and I stood in front of the house. I had the two kids. My son was 19. He had kind of left. He'd gone into training in theater and with his relatives and training him for dancing and stuff. And he had kind of left the house. But I'm sitting there on those steps with those two kids. And one friend, I have an Israeli friend, she still lives in Woodland Hills, had put some money in an envelope and just sealed it. And left it. And I just didn't pay much attention to it. And when the marshal put the lock on and he locked it away, he just looked at me and moved away, and I'm sitting there. And I had one little bag with clothes in it for the two kids, the two younger ones. The son walked down the street, and he saw me sitting on the steps because I had no place to go. I had no place to go. My family had said, we love you, but goodbye. We just cannot. They didn't know anything about Al-Anon, but that's the best thing in the world they could have done for me. My son walked up to me and he said, I don't know where you're going. He said, but you know, you've never been there for us. And I'm not going wherever you're going because I don't want to watch you die. And that son walked away, and my arrogance as an alcoholic, and my arrogance said, and screw you too. I dealt with that in my amends step with him. I opened that envelope and there was some money in there and an address, and it was over in South Central off of Slauson and Crenshaw, and you know about that area. And I walk up there and she'd made these arrangements for me and paid this money for the rent, for the first month's rent. I walk up those steps. I opened that door, and I drew the drapes, and I think I was doomed to die of this disease. And those kids looked around. They'd never seen any us live that way. And I got dressed for the journey. I bought myself a white terracloth robe and a bright red wig. I don't know why I bought the wig. You know, I thought maybe, you know, I just, so nobody would recognize me down there. I'd never been down there before. I'm used to hanging out with stars. And I used to get drunk. The wig had bangs, and I used to get drunk off that Ripple wine and trim the bangs. And I mean, they would be zigzag, and you know, it got so bad that the grandparents took the kids and moved them down to Santa Monica. And now the drapes are really drawn because I was down there for 3 years. And I would come through out of those blackouts, sitting in front of the television. In those days, it was still black and white, and watching it turn over. And my heart, you know, would just be pounding from fear. And I had to get out of there and, you know, and go hear the music. And I'd get into all those sleazy bars down there around over 104th, 13th, 104th Street in that area where, I mean, it's bad now. It was terrible then. And I loved, I don't know if you were bar drinkers. I loved sitting, going to those sleazy bars, sitting on that stool, that end stool. That was my favorite stool, and looking in that mirror. You know, probably feeling like Eleanor Rigby, wondering where all those other lonely people were coming from. And you know, we wine was 49 cents a glass, and we drank out of the barrel. It didn't have any labels on it. We don't know what we drank. It just came out of that barrel, and the bartender would just, no risk ask, just wine, beer and wine. And you know, every once in a while, you know, I would meet some guys on that, you know. Loneliness is part of our disease. And I knew if I could just find somebody to talk to, instead of coming to our in a fee position on a dirty floor. And once in a while, you know, I'll tell you about one that was very interesting. He was a very nice looking guy, kind of looked like Denzel Washington type. Now, by now, I got wine sores on my face and my body. I'm 65 pounds overweight. I'm living off food stamps and welfare and hustling whatever little change I could get, wherever, the way ever I could do it. You know, alcoholism is a disease and it has no gender. But as an alcoholic woman, I tell you, I want to tell you the price. The book calls it pitiful, incomprehensible demoralization. And I remember those moments. And I remember, you know, not being able to identify the face. And I'm sitting there, and this guy turned to me, and he said, he introduced himself. He told me he was a retired lieutenant colonel in the United States Air Force. I was really impressed because he was about 24 years old. And I said, "You really?" He said, "Yeah, honey." He said, "I fly secret missions." He's drinking 49 cent wine too. He said, "I fly secret missions all over the world." And I was impressed because in those days, the United States used to have what they call U-2 planes. That circular word, they don't have it now, but to see what the other part of the world was doing. And I said, "Wow." And he took it, he said, "Can I have a sip of your wine?" I said, "Yeah." He took a sip of my wine, and then he looked at me and he said, "Yeah, last night I flew over Russia." I took a sip of my wine, and I looked at him, and I said, "I know you did, darling, because I was with you on that trip." So, you know, that's the kind of drinking we were doing. And those are the kind of men, the relationships I was meeting off the bar. But what would happen at that awful hour of the morning? I come to our black house in front of that house at 3 and 4 o'clock in the morning in a field position in tall, wet grass. In those days, the dogs traveled in packs in that area. It was all about survival. And they had metal trash cans in those days. And it would take several of those dogs to push the can into the street where they looked for garbage and some food. And I could still hear the lid rolling down the street. And I'm in the grass talking to a God I don't believe in and saying, "If you just get me off the ground, get up off that ground and get up those stairs and get down that filthy house where I lived and the conditions to the bathroom, it was dirty and on my knees, my chin rolling around on that cold porcelain, and I'd go into a blackout. It would seem to me that times I would throw up my very soul when I wasn't eating in those days. I was just drinking. I'd come to the blackout with my head leaning against the cold porcelain, and the two words that always greeted me was American Standard. I'd just then stare at it, you know. And then I'd get up, and then that's the way it just kept going. Finally, one morning, one more time on a Sunday morning in Inglewood, I don't know how I got up, still trying to be a party girl, still hanging on those bars. We didn't have cell phones in those days. They had pay stations out around the city. And one more time, I come to out of a blackout. I remember a leg with a cowboy boot. I never saw the face. And these boots had cleats on the end. My head was against where the forum is now. Wasn't there? It was right where in that area, at Crenshaw and Prairie View Avenue in that area. This dude was kicking me in the head. I know about pain, and that pain has no memory. In the Big Book of Alcoholics Anonymous, it describes the second step of insanity, because it describes the jaywalker who kept doing the same things over and over again and always expected a different result. I kept doing those things. He was kicking me in the head, and I was going in and out of consciousness, not because of I was drunk, because medically they say, you know, the body can only handle so much pain, and the unconsciousness is because you can't feel any more pain. When I came to again, I was in Daniel Freeman Hospital in Englewood. I don't know if any of you know where that is. Nuns leaning over me, police, the paramedics. They didn't have paramedics like they have now, but they had some guys in a black, you know, I don't know what it was. It looked like a hearse, but I think it was, well, I don't know how they got me there. And there was an older nun, and she had on horn-rimmed glasses, and she was leaning over me. And she had her hands in the sleeves. And the paramedics had hooked me up to some kind of equipment that was pumping my, getting me alive. I kept jumping like that until I was alive. The police kept saying, and the nun said to the police, you tell them who did this. I still don't know. I'm 34 years sober. I have no idea who it was. But I learned from the mafia, you know, you don't tell them anything. I said to this nun, buzz off. And she turned and she walked away. She stood in the door for a few moments. And she must have been in her 60s. She had her hands in the sleeves. And she just looked back at me and just shook her head. And something happened, that moment of clarity. Because people had all been telling me to stop drinking and what to do. The paramedics left. The police left. But the young nun stood there in her early 20s. I call her my earth angel. She had on this white habit, and all I could see, she was wiping the blood out of the corner. I had a brain concussion. She was wiping the blood out of the corner of my eyes, and he kicked in all my ribs. And she was wiping the blood away, and she started to cry. She looked down at me, and she said, "How did you ever let your life get into such a state?" I looked up at this young nun, and I shook my head because I never thought alcohol was the reason I was there. It was people, places, and things. If they get off my back and stop, that was my problem. 3 days later, she dressed me, and you should have seen her trying to put the wig on. You know, all of them, even the Catholic hospitals, 72 hours for alcoholics. And you should have seen her trying to figure out where the bangs went on that wig. She was, you know, she was moving it around. And I was, by this time, I had, my joints were so swollen, my ankles, I couldn't wear shoes. So I had on my favorite gold fuzzy house slippers. And she put her arms around me and she said, "Try not to drink today." And ladies and gentlemen, I am an alcoholic. I shuffled away, bandaged up, because I couldn't stand up to hold the ribs in. A brain concussion, I went to the nearest liquor store. That's the insanity of the disease. And I bought some wine. And 3 weeks later, I don't know what happened. That morning, that was different from a lot of the other mornings. But I came to. It was April the 9th, 1974, an early morning, and I was on the floor, and the stench of the wine in an unkempt body, and I hope I never forget that moment, because when I came off that floor, I just stood up and started to cry, and I said, "God, just don't let me die. I'm going to die." And that was my moment of truth. I was telling you about Georgia and the music, and I loved it. And it was always a requirement when you got to be a teenager was to sing in the choir. And I remember those songs, and they were all spirituals. And the old song books, they were yellow. because in those days, most of the spirituals were never, they never had anyone who wrote the lyrics, but the slaves in the fields of Georgia used to sing those songs, and that's how they were written. And I remember one of the songs was about 15 years old that used to always touch me, and the lyrics went something like, soon one morning, death came knocking on my door. Oh, my Lord, what shall I do? And that was, I believe, was my spiritual awakening, because the power of God that I have come to believe in must have kissed me gently and said, you don't have to live like an animal again. I called that same friend, Rachel. I went to the phone, and I called this number. She said, it's called Alcoholics Anonymous. Call them. They'll help you. They help each other stay sober. I went to the phone, and I called this man, this gentleman answered. He said, good morning. My name is Jim. He said, and I'm an alcoholic. How can I help you? And I said, man, in my best street language, I said, I think I'm going to die if I don't stop drinking. He said, welcome to Alcoholics Anonymous. Told me where to go to meetings and that night. And I got dressed that day for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous. I could pull out a red dress, and it had wine stains on it, and I cleaned up the wig. And he asked me one simple question that I asked newcomers today: do you think you can just not drink today? Nobody ever asked me that. And he said, well, you promised me you'll just try it. And I said, I'll try that. And so I went off to, you know, I wanted to look good because I didn't know who you guys were, and I just wanted to. So I went over to Woolworths. During that last ride over in that area, they burnt that one down, but it was there when I went up. And so I had on a leather jacket, and I was just browsing, trying to get, it was an 8 o'clock meeting, but I wanted to be dressed by 7, just to keep from going to the liquor store. I stayed in there for about an hour, going just from counter to counter, looking. So I stole some eyelashes for my first meeting of Alcoholics Anonymous, so I'd look good. They come long. I didn't know you're supposed to trim them down to size. And, you know, at 7 o'clock, I put them under my jacket. I beat it back to that house. And at 7 o'clock, I'm standing in front of the mirror, and now I'm detoxing. I don't know what that means, but I'm shaking like a leaf. I'm perspiring. And I didn't know what was happening to my body. And I grabbed these, I had on my wig, I was looking good, you know, I really, and I borrowed my brother's car, he worked at Delta Airlines, and they come with a little tube of glue, and I was shaking so badly, I remember squeezing it along the edge, and grabbing my elbow, and waiting for an opportune moment. I slammed it in, and one end was up here, and the other end was down there. I was too tired to start all over. I leaned in the mirror, I said, you are looking good, and, I went off to my first meeting, and it's been the journey ever since. And I went to that meeting that night. I met my sponsor, who's still my sponsor today at that night. The meetings were small, and I was taught right from the beginning to get into the books and to be of service, and that's what has been my journey for. I haven't been out there since that meeting. I mean, since that day of April the 9th, 1974. I got into those steps, and if you knew, that's how it all begins, and that's how we stay here. I started to my on the men's list. My first names were my kids. My older son had become very famous as a performer in Broadway shows, and he was in New York at the time. And he was with the ABC television, and he was the anchor for people like Barbara Walters, and he was doing well. It took him 4 years to come back to see me. But I made my amends to the next, the others. I remember how difficult the fourth column of the inventory step. There's four columns there. The fourth column was a column for me to take responsibility for my action and behavior during those years of my alcoholism and with the family and other people. So I made amends to my two younger ones, and I remember putting them in the room, sitting them down in the room, and telling them how sorry I was that I was a sick person, That was not an excuse, but I was a sober member of Alcoholics Anonymous, and I didn't have to live like that anymore. And, you know, kids, I mean, at that age, you know, they accepted it, you know. So anyway, we got on with our lives, and the promises started to come true. I saw my daughter go into the Ice Capades. The grandparents is one of the first black professional ice skaters with the Dorothy Hamill tour, and I was buried in Alcoholics Anonymous. I still am, because this is my life and this is what I love. When I was 3 years sober, I went back into that company I lost, and I have this company now for 28 years. That older son, we became friends. He came back to L.A. to do some shows, and we became very good friends. And this is in the late 80s, and he was at that time, as I told you, what he was doing. But I don't know if any of you have heard of Studio 54. Well, he got involved with the celebrities of Studio 50. That's when drugs first were coming on the streets. Now, I hung in those clubs with all the famous people, Dinah Washington, Alina Hall, all of them. And in those days, drugs were always out there, but they were always in the private clubs, those jazz clubs, because the mafia owned all of those clubs. So we used to close the door, and I used to see it all. But I never touched the hard drugs. My hard drug was alcohol. So he got involved in that group. And so he had 3 more years of contract there. And he called me one night, and he said, "Mom, you know, I'm getting really worried. I'm getting really worried about what I'm doing." But I didn't know what he was doing. And so when his contract was over, he came back to L.A., got married, and had a little son. My little grandson is he's 20 years old now. But the marriage didn't last, and he moved to San Francisco to teach his theater arts at that level. And in 1989, he called me. "Mom," he said, "I went to the doctor. I don't feel well. And they tell me I've got something called HIV. And in those days, that was it. No medication, nothing. And by this time, he said, "But I'll keep working until I can't work." Because he had been shooting cocaine and sharing the needle in Studio 54. And he called me 19 months later, "Mom, I can't work because I'm going to die. And I want to come home to die. And here's a little boy I couldn't take to the park. But because of the grace of God and the program of Alcoholics Anonymous and trying to live by its principles, you see, I had a place for him. Thank you, God." And he came home, and my daughter is happily married and doing well. And we all gathered around him. You knew you never have to do anything alone again, because members of Alcoholics Anonymous are always there. A lot of old-timers like Bob, you guys know Bob. You know, Bob is here. He was one of my mentors. That's, you know, and they were all there for us. And I had a private place for him. And you know, we were all. And he'd done some work, and maybe you newcomers know something about the Grateful Dead. And he'd done some work for them, some lyrics. They heard he was dying of AIDS. And he went from a handsome young man to 100 pounds. And I sat for days. We talked about a lot of things. And that's why we have those steps in the eighth and ninth step. You know, when that moment comes that we don't have to, you know, try to make it all up. We've lived the living amends. That's what Al-Anon and AA is about. And it was 10:30 on a Saturday morning, and all my sponsees and my family and members of Alcoholics Anonymous were around that bed. And the Grateful Dead had written some lyrics for him, and he had asked us to sing it because he could no longer talk. Their mouth gets white inside, and I used to take the straw and dip water onto their lips. And the danger we were all in, because we didn't know anything about the virus. But we sang that song, and that rasping sound of death, and he was gone. And I pray that his soul rode the wings of angels to a higher place, no more crying and no more dying. And I get the opportunity to come and share my experience, strength, and hope with you that the program of Alcoholics Anonymous works if we do the work, And it gives us I've had the freedom I never had in my life. And when I tell you I'm 83 years old, these have been the best years of my life through God's grace and you. Thank you.